Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. My co-host and colleague Sam can't be with us today, so I'll be doing this solo. One of the issues that has been difficult for many commentators, for many citizens who aren't commentators, is how to talk about some of the events that we've seen come out of Washington, how to deal with some of the unprecedented, unconventional aspects of this presidency, or how to talk about aspects of Donald Trump that those who have been following him long before he was president of the United States were always aware of. I grew up near the New York area, so I've been watching his exploits for a long time. And one of the kind of methods that people probably don't use enough of is some humor. And the mix of humor and political commentary, to me, feels more urgent than ever before, and figuring out thoughtful ways to do this is important. And today we have with us Ellis Hennigan, who is a journalist and a best-selling author. He has been a columnist for Newsday, and now he is writing for Metro Papers, and he appears on many different television stations. He's appeared on Fox, CNN, MSNBC, and he is the author of a really, really fun new book that recently came out called Trumpitude, The Secret Confessions of Donald Trump's Brain, which he wrote with art by Randy Jones. So, Ellis, welcome to our show.
Hey, Julian, it's great to be with you.
So, Ellis, let me just start. You write a lot about American politics. You comment on American politics, and you chose to write this book in a very particular way. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about why you made the choice to mix cartoons and humor in discussing this president.
Well, Julian, if we have a postmodern president now, right, where a whole lot of the rules that we thought applied don't necessarily apply anymore, I think we need to use every single imaginable communication tool. I haven't decided that, well, I'm going to give up serious commentary, or I'm going to give up arguing with you on CNN in order to just do, funny bathroom books about Trump. But you know what? There's stuff you can do in this kind of format. There's a sort of a truth you can get to this way that isn't as easy if you're writing a long investigative piece or a traditional op-ed column. So I'm just for doing it every way we can think of.
And so is there a serious question behind the humor that drove you as you wrote this book? Was there something on your mind that you want to say about this presidency in the format that you do?
Yeah, a few things. One is that this whole question of what does a fact mean? What can we believe? Is there some kind of, basic catechism of life that we all subscribe to? It seems like there really isn't anymore. So if we're going to assess what Trump land is like, and what the guy at the center of it really stands for and means in politics and to our culture and to our future, it just seems to me you got to start poking into some of those questions about how he thinks. Literally, you got to climb inside his head and try and figure out what's going on in there.
And you call it a cheat sheet for his brain, or to his brain, which is interesting. And I don't think that's irrelevant, because, I can't think of how many times people are openly wondering, whatever format they're discussing the president, what is he thinking, or what do his words mean? What do his tweets mean? It really seems to be a puzzle often what's going on in there in a way I can't think with other presidents.
No, and it's a wild and scary place. I've tried to think of different analogies. Right? The best I've come up with is that it's like standing in the middle of a paintball fight. Right. And people are shooting at you from all directions. And you don't really know what's going to hit and what's going to miss. But you do know this: you're not likely to get out clean. And I think that's not just true of me doing the book. I think that's true of all of us who talk about this stuff. And frankly, everyone who lives through it.
And you've been following Donald Trump for a long time in the New York area. And you have a pretty good feel for who he is. And you start the book with it's great. It's like a short history of major moments. And then you tell us what the lesson learned, lesson learned should be. So, you know, major moment, December 31st, 1977, Donald Trump Jr. is born, followed by Ivanka, Mary Trump and Eric Frederick Trump, busy at work. Their father leaves most of the child rearing to his wife. Lesson learned, women are better at some things than men. And another major moment, October 1st, 2004, Donald Trump's signature collection, including fat red neckties, arrives in department stores. Lesson learned, shoppers will buy anything at all with a celebrity's name at it. Why do you take us through that history?
Well, because that explains who this guy is. By the way, you should also add that being made in China is not normally a problem on the retailing side. Listen, this guy comes with a whole set of experiences and attitudes that we've never seen, certainly not at this level in politics. And so you got to get inside the way that he thinks. I tell you, Julian, the way I started trying to come up with the specific ideas for the book, it sort of was the notion of Trump explaining to you how to be like Trump, you know, that like separated from anybody telling him he's not supposed to be. You know, there's clearly a unifying set of attitudes here. And yet I didn't feel like, you know, despite all of the pundit segments and the columns and the other ways that we've approached this, that I was ever really able to get at that other than, you know, in some figurative way, you know, hey, let's climb inside the guy's head and let's poke around a little bit, see what we find.
And so here's one other that you talk about in this history section, which is, I don't know, it struck me as interesting. Major moment, December 20th, 1993, after divorcing his wife, Ivana, Donald marries actress and fitness buff Marla Maples, mother of 2-month-old Tiffany Trump. Lesson learned, don't be a stickler for the old-fashioned order of things.
All right. Well,
what do you mean?
While you're telling others that they should follow that, yeah.
And how does that tell us a little bit about him? I mean, that seems very relevant for his presidency.
Well, may I describe to you the first time I met Donald in person?
Yes, for sure.
So this is it's right around the era you're talking about, right?
Yep.
The early 90s. So I'm a young reporter at New York Newsday. And Donald, of course, is a guy that we all cover from time to time. It wasn't a full-time beat, but, you know, he was constantly popping up in the news. And I was sent up to his office in Trump Tower with a photographer, this for New York Newsday. I never met him before, but, you know, I knew who he was. His divorce was all over the papers. And I think I was supposed to ask him some question. I think it had to do with the Central Park Five, that case that he jumped into. But honestly, I forget what the story was. But I went up there and came into the office. I said good morning to Norma, his assistant, who you kind of had to suck up to get in to see Donald. And was ushered into the office. He comes around the back of the desk, and the first thing that strikes me is how big he is, right? He's, I mean, anyone who's seen him in person, he's surprising how big he is. Mm-hmm. He's just a big guy, and he's gotten a little chunkier in recent years, but he's a husky guy. And he had in his hand 2 photographs, and I was kind of glancing at them, and I could see that they were 2 photographs of women, headshots of blonde women. And as I looked more closely, I could see that one was Ivana, his soon-to-be ex-wife, and the other was Marla, this woman that he was more than rumored to be keeping company with. And the first thing out of his mouth after, hey, come on in, was, so, he said, which one's hotter? Mm. Now, you know, I was young. I wasn't, maybe I was a little, you know, nervous being up there. I was trying to think of like what the right answer to that
right.
was. First, I was thinking neither one of these women would want him talking like that, right?
Yeah.
I know my wife wouldn't want me talking like that. And I came up with the best answer I could, which was, well, you know, they're both very attractive young
very
ladies.
Diplomatic.
Right. Now, today I would hope I would have more of a smart-ass response. I would say, you know, why stop with 2 or some other kind of, you know, equally, you know, trashy locker room comeback. I wasn't as quick at the time. But I got to tell you, Julian, I think that he would say the same thing today. I don't think there has been a maturation process. I think there is a kind of, you know, old world bonding thing that goes on with the guy. But, you know, I think the guy that I met in the office that day in 1992 is really not so different from the guy who's sitting in the Oval Office at 1600 Pennsylvania.
And how would you describe that beyond the photograph choice? I mean, what do you mean by that?
Well, that he's someone who's self-absorbed, who delights in making people kind of gasp a little bit, who feels like he controls the room and controls the dialogue and controls the agenda by being in that kind of cocky, larger-than-life way. I think those techniques served him well over the years as a public figure and in some ways as a real estate developer. I would say that those instincts are not serving him quite as well as president, that he's kind of met his match in a way that he didn't, you know, going mano a mano against tabloid reporters like me and the New York political system, you know, which he was kind of able to dominate in a lot of ways. I think it's those techniques and attitudes are not serving him quite as well. And I think he's as a result, he's, you know, having trouble getting stuff through Congress, and he seems to be flailing on the international stage, and he's angering allies that he doesn't have any reason to anger. But I got to tell you, I think it all goes back to that same kind of, you know, self-absorbed outlook on life that I try to poke fun at in Trumpitude.
Do you think... So the heart of your book, I think, is, which people are going to love, this Trump to English translator. And you'll have a quote of something he said, and then you'll explain it in English, what he meant. And so there's two ways to read that humor. One is this is someone who is full of it, who says one thing but means another. The other is that he actually has something he wants to say, meaning there are ideas, as much as someone might dislike them or love them, behind his thought. And that's one of the puzzles of the Trump presidency. Is this just chaos of someone who's self-absorbed, saying whatever's on their mind, whatever they watch on TV, whatever he sees on Fox and Friends, and responding? Or is there something there, perhaps devious, but an agenda, a set of ideas? Where do you fall on that?
Boy, what a good question. Let's see if you and I can pick it apart together. First of all, yeah. I don't doubt the sincerity ever. I mean, I think he believes every single word that tumbles off of his lips. Now, in 5 seconds, he may say something that contradicts that previous word with a new word, and he'll believe that one just as well. The problem is not sincerity. It might at times be self-delusion, but I don't question the belief. I mean, I think he really feels like he's being picked on by the special counsel. I really think he has the frustrations that he describes with the Republican Party. He believes all of that stuff. I don't believe that there is a deeply held philosophical worldview here, because it's changed too much over the years. You know, I think he's made what is kind of a calculation, a strategic calculation, that, for instance, that in terms of the ideology of his presidency, that his best choice is to align with the kind of traditional conservative Republican view of the world and try and push that political agenda. But there's nowhere in his history that he's ever shown any great allegiance to that. I mean, he's never been a social conservative, for God's sake. I think that's a kind of a shifting sand there. But boy, he believes it today, even if he believes something different tomorrow.
Where do you think? So one of the more disturbing parts of the presidency has clearly been his response to Charlottesville, or the way in which he will retweet or absorb some of the rhetoric of really nasty extremist groups in different parts of the political spectrum. We saw that the Britain First retweet of those videos, anti-Islamophobic videos. That was clearly the intention. How genuine is that part of who he is, or is that just him, you know, being the head of a carnival and bringing in whoever he thinks will get him the biggest show?
Yeah, and poking his finger in people's eye. I mean, one of the themes that does come up over and over again is this sort of, you know, anti-PC thing, right?
Right.
I mean, the notion that, you know, all you other people are just you're a bunch of nervous Nellies, basically. You know, you're captives of worrying about things too much. And he's going to not be a captive of that. And part of that is just saying stuff. I mean, I had an uncle like that, right? Who just liked coming into the family gatherings and just saying stuff that would just, you know, cause a lot of uproar. And it's, you know, there's a certain delight you can get in that. And I think that's what it's really about. You know, I mean, you can, yes, you can look at the anti-Muslim videos and say, wow, that's pretty racist. And, you know, that's correct, I think. I mean, I would agree with that. But I don't think that's exactly what's motivating. I think it's just coming in and turning over the furniture.
And then I'll just read one, the Trump English translator. You have a comment at a press conference after the election. He said, the only one that cares about my tax returns are the reporters. English translation, reporters make no money. They pay no taxes. And all they have to worry about are mine. And that's a great one. And it gets to the heart of another issue we've been talking about and following. That's this very adversarial relationship he has with at least parts of the press, not all of the press. But he's clearly at least made them, from, you know, the Washington Post to CNN, he's made them one of his chief enemies, his chief targets, even ironically as he uses the press to advance his agenda constantly. What's your take on this tension that's unfolded relative to other presidents you've seen, and what do you think the implications are for the media?
Well, first of all, his version of it is cartoonish, right? Uh-huh. I mean, it's the punching bag, right? It's recognizing that, you know, hey, everybody hates the media, and so you're pretty free in bashing the media. And not a lot of penalty for it. I mean, we just kind of, you know, shrug and move on. I do think it does have some kind of underlying dangers that you're alluding at. I mean, the world is better off if we have a self-confident, you know, fair but aggressive press. He and those around him do a lot to try and undermine that, and I do think that has bad consequences. You know, the worldview that says there's no right or wrong, it's just tribal, and it's my team against your team, is right at the center of Trump's view of himself and of America today. And that gets applied to a lot of things, including the media. The good news is that we've done the best work in years. I mean, there has been amazing reporting going on. And we should, frankly, feel pretty proud of that, I think.
And then another, and I'm only reading a few of these because everyone has to buy the book. But you have this great cartoon, which got me thinking. I don't know how you did the cartoon, the drawing, the illustrations versus the text. But the headline is extremely credible. And there's a picture of Trump with his hand on the ear, just kind of picking something up, some kind of conversation. And underneath it says, something I think I heard somewhere. And there's many moments you feel that's part of what's going on in terms of his responses or statements. He hears something and he instantly tweets out his response without really thinking it through, without really understanding it. So it's a great image. You think that's part of how this all is working in the Oval Office?
Yeah. I, you know, if you can start any wild sentence by saying, well, some people think, you know, or I heard somewhere, you know, you in academia and in the media and me, you know, banging around as a reporter and a columnist, we learn early in the game that there is a certain rigor that is expected of us that is a little higher than, hey, I heard somewhere or some guy in a bar told me. But, you know, in the political world, it turns out there's less of an enforcement mechanism there than we thought, you know, and that's become a routine kind of locution, I guess you'd call it. And often it's, you're right, the day starts with the conversation on Fox and Friends, and it kind of goes from there. But, you know, it's a kind of effective way to put out any crazy stuff. Oh, and by the way, when people object to it factually, you can say, well, I didn't say that was true. I just was kind of passing on what I heard or maybe heard somewhere.
I think that's really what you just said is really an important part of what we've witnessed, that I think we're getting our heads around it. And I'm not sure what the implications will be, that there's less of an enforcement mechanism than we thought. And we have seen this so many times since he started his campaign. He does something which the assumption is you can't do that, or somehow it's checked, or someone's going to stop it. And yet he does it. And there's no one, you know, watching the store. And I think it's exposed all sorts of vulnerabilities and dysfunctional parts of American politics. Your book itself, you know, you have a list of things he says that aren't true or they mean something totally different. And yet this is exactly what's going on. And there's no check on it.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And it does show that some of our institutions, maybe including our own, maybe, you know, the media and academics, there is a hollowness to it. I mean, we always assumed that, you know, if we wrote 3 days worth of horrible stories about somebody, we could basically drive them away or wear them out or run them down. And maybe it turns out that if you're just on the target side of that, if you just don't ever apologize, you don't ever leave, you just assert whatever you want to assert, that, you know, you can kind of ride it out. And maybe that is one of the lessons. I'm not sure what our tool is in response to that. I don't think we figured it out yet. But, man, we better start thinking about that.
How New York is this president?
A lot. I mean, his attitude, his culture, his swagger is all New York. What's interesting to me is how well that's gone over elsewhere. I mean, I think he's less popular in New York than he is when I go home to Louisiana, where I grew up, or you know, when I'm traveling in other parts of the country. That kind of, again, caricature of New Yorker, people are familiar with. We used to think they were prejudiced against it. But you know what? TV kind of changes that. He's just a, you know, he's just a character for people.
But there is a funny part of that, meaning he has sold the ultimate, or at least one of the ultimate caricatures of New York, to parts of the country that usually don't like what New York is about, at least in theory. And yet somehow he sold himself as this populist in rural, less educated areas, even when his policies defy any semblance of doing anything about these issues. Is he just a great salesman? Is he an effective salesman? Is that how he's done it?
I guess. I mean, you have to say to which audience, because clearly it's selling better in some circles than in others. And don't forget how powerful the big entertainment media still is. You know, most people knew Donald Trump from The Apprentice as the guy who's saying you're fired. And that was a, you know, a really simple concept. It was easy to understand. You know, he became a huge, you know, hugely recognized character in homes across America. And you know, that's very valuable. That really is the currency of today in a way that, you know, in previous generations, power came from, you know, having the party bosses with you or having the polls on your side or having the right endorsements. Man, none of that stuff matters compared to being the star of a network television show.
And then you have a great section at the end, finish Trump's thought. And he'll say something. Nobody knew healthcare could be so complicated. And then you say, except for Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, both parties in Congress, big pharma, big insurance, all patients, all nurses, all doctors, including Dr. Phil, Dr. John, and Dr. Dre. That section, and you have lots of great ones in there. Let me ask this. Why is it funny? I mean, it is funny. So why is that?
Well, you know, I think what's funny is the recognition, yep. Right? I mean, when you read something or hear something, I mean, I know this, I'm sure you do, as an audience member, you know, that kind of has this recognition that's said in some way that's sharper or clearer with some kind of unexpected twist, but it rings true. And you say, aha, yeah, that's it. I think it makes you smile. I mean, let's be honest. There's a lot to cry about, right? I mean, there are all kinds of things we can be depressed all day long, and maybe that's appropriate. But, you know, I don't want to live like that. I don't think most of the folks in your audience want to live like that. So, hey, you know what? That's how we respond. We laugh about stuff. We make fun of it. We try to find some truth in the humor. And honestly, that's why I was really drawn to do the book. It just seemed like another way to try and get to some of the stuff I've been trying to talk about in a bunch of other forums.
Do you think we've normalized a lot of it in that's why the humor sticks? We actually now know a little bit about what he's thinking, or we could understand the sequence of his statement and what the answer will be, where some things which maybe a year and a half ago he would have said, oh my God, no one can say mm-hmm. that, or what is that about? We're almost at the point where we get the punchline, or it's a familiar punchline. Do you think that's happened?
Yeah, Yeah, and it's not a good thing. I mean, I have had people in the response to this book over the last week or so since it came out, saying, "Well, you shouldn't be joking about this. Mm-hmm. You know, this is serious. I mean, this is the future of our republic. This is our, you know, these are major issues that affect real people, and all of that's true. I mean, it's a in a way, I guess, a fair critique." You know, I have a comeback. I would say, well, you know, I'm not saying quit investigating. You know, it's just another route to try and make a point. But I mean, at some point you do get worn down. You know, at some point you aren't shocked at the 5 a.m. tweet anymore after you've had it for 375 days, whatever it is now. You know, it does wear you down, and it's incumbent, I think, on, you know, all of us who are in the game of reacting to it, to try and find ways to keep it fresh and interesting and present it in ways that, you know, that we don't get boring, because, man, we lose it if that happens.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's actually very effective. First, just the humor in the book does make a point. And I think whether it's the illustrations or whether it's some of the examples I mentioned, you get at the heart of questions that people are asking in different outlets and in different ways, in very powerful fashion. And it is, there needs to be some freshness of the discussion. Otherwise, it's so repetitive. That's exactly how it becomes normalized. You're not listening anymore.
Yeah, well, you and I need to keep thinking of new ones. I mean, maybe we should do a rock opera or a graphic novel or right. Iambic pentameter, doggerel. Tell me. And we just have to keep thinking up new ways to tell this story, or we're going to lose the audience.
Right. And humor has been a very effective way of generating discussion with this and other presidencies. But certainly, you know, SNL has probably been one of the more talked about shows week in and week out about how they cover what's going on in the White House.
Yeah, and it's been good. And what makes it good is that it's funny, but they also, I think you put your finger on it, they also get to some truth that is a little harder to get to through the traditional routes. And you know what? It's just, to me, it was something that no one else had really done. It seemed like, you know, there was some demand for it. And I'll tell you, you know, I joke about this, but it's a whole lot looser, more fun to write books that have one or two lines on a page than the ones that have, you know, all that boring type on a page, Julian.
Right. It's that is true. But a few words can often be very powerful. What do you think if you could get a copy of this book onto his desk? What would he think?
You know, I've been hoping he's going to tweet about it. That will keep me on the Times list for the next 18 weeks. Yeah. You know, I don't honestly, if you're asking that question seriously, I don't think he's someone who has a lot of humor about himself.
Uh-huh.
I think he feels beleaguered.
Right.
I think he's got a little bit of a paranoid streak, honestly. You know, he feels picked on by people who are either not picking on him or so small that he shouldn't be worried about their picking on him. When the father of a college basketball player says something, he reacts, I think, in genuine anger. I mean, I don't think that's just theater. I think he's really, you know, he's really mad, I think. And so, you know, I would love it. And there are people in politics who are able to laugh at themselves. And we treasure that. We've had presidents who had great senses of humor. But I don't see him taking it into the John in 1600 and opening up a page and saying, hey, that guy really got me. Uh-huh. I, you know, maybe I'm underestimating, but I'm not holding my breath on that one.
And how did you, one last question about the book itself. This is a little different than most of what you write, and you collaborated, obviously, with an illustrator. How did you go about putting this book together, deciding where there should be images, and how you should put each section together so that it moved along?
Yeah. First of all, I loved doing it. It was really fun. I mean, Randy is a very talented, kind of twisted guy who's, you know, whose stuff is in the Times and the Journal, and you know, he's a big time guy in that world. And mechanically, I would come up with the idea. I mean, I would say, you know, let's do something off of Confifi, you know, and here's what I'm thinking, and he would go off on his own, draw something, and send it to me, kind of a rough of it. And then we would play around with it, and I would usually either write or help him write, you know, the cut line to the to the illustration. And he couldn't stop. I mean, initially we'd agreed he would do like, you know, 20 or 25 illustrations. I think they got to be, I don't know, 75 in the book. I didn't count them. But, and he's still sending the damn things to me.
I say, Randy, post-publication.
Let's wait for volume two. I mean, don't leave it in the locker room. The book is already in print. You got to stop. And I think I might have created a monster, honestly.
Well, I think everyone's going to enjoy the product, so I wouldn't worry about it. It looks like you might have volume two on the way. thanks again to Ellis. Your new book, Ellis Hennigan, Trumpitude, The Secret Confessions of Donald Trump's Brain, and it is published by Post Hill Press. It's a really, really fun book. It's definitely, I'm sure you're telling people, it's a great gift. And I think not.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.